On this episode, we'll continue our discussions about how the COVID pandemic may be moving on to an endemic phase, and if true, how this is significant for healthcare for you and for your practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Villanueva, Principal of Operations and Quality at Vizient and Practicing Internist. I welcome back Dr. Maddie McDowell, Senior Principal for Intelligence at Vizient, and Dr. Marty Lucenti, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for Solution Architecture at Vizient. Maddie, Marty, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
So do vaccines have anything to do with getting to an endemic state?
Yes, they have. For COVID, they have almost everything to do with getting to an endemic state.
At least at this point, in the first world nations, they are the cornerstone of getting to an endemic state. In some of the third world countries, as of yet, we haven't gotten an aggressive enough distribution approach to our vaccines for that to be necessarily a strategy in some of the third world countries. Hopefully that will change with time. So right now, one of the greatest, some will argue, one of the good fortunes of a very contagious, less pathogenic virus like Omicron is it was, to some extent, the vaccination program for the third world that we haven't been able to quite operationalize. So I think it is the cornerstone of the first world. I hope we can get better at the distribution. I still think natural immunity plays a big part in the transition to endemic in the third world until we get better on the distribution of vaccine front.
Yeah, I'm curious, Maddie, do you think that actually worldwide vaccinations are actually going to be necessary to control some of these variants going into the future?
The reason we have variants is widespread transmission. And so if we can reduce the widespread transmission through vaccination, we could get into a situation where we have very few variants coming down the pipeline. So yes, I think that's the goal of all the public health measures now.
Should everyone get boosted? Marty, I know you have some thoughts.
you know, here's the thing. It's very clear to me that anybody with any risks should absolutely get boosted. The data for boosters in the healthy early adolescent phase is a little less clear at this point, but that probably will declare itself as we get longer out from the original vaccination of those populations. I would say data is very clear for anybody with risk factors. It's becoming very clear with anybody from middle age up. It's still, the data is a little sparse on the adolescent population, but that may just be because they got vaccinated late. We haven't had the duration of time and the loss of immunity that you get, you know, the erosion of immunity with time in that population, plus immunity erodes slower in that group. I haven't seen the data to validate that yet, but Maddie may have. But that group, I think we're still looking for a little bit more data.
How about you, Maddie? What do you think?
So we do find immunity wanes both for natural infection a little faster and the vaccinated population faster than we had expected to, 5 to 6 months. And so the boosters are very important for high-risk people, even moderate-risk people. But I also think, because again, we're all connected, if you're exposed to close contact with elderly people like grandparents, it is important for those younger populations to consider getting boosted as well. But I do think it's something that we don't quite know the timing. We do expect to see new mRNA vaccines, they're calling them now genetic-based vaccines, to be developed to impact, to better target the variants. So those boosters will have even a different role rather than just boosting your regular immunity, it would be targeted.
Maddie, being a pediatrician, what about kids? Should we be vaccinating our children?
I think it's a very good idea to vaccinate children because of a couple of reasons. One, especially during the Omicron, we did see some very severe cases. While it's rare, it is something that is filling up our hospitals, our children's hospitals. And the second reason is it does help us get to an endemic state. And the third reason being that children are exposed to high-risk people, teachers, parents, grandparents, etc. The vaccines are safe and we don't have them under age 5. And it's interesting, there's really two camps. There's probably people who do not want their children to be vaccinated. And then there's people who probably are just counting the days till their young children can get vaccinated. We all know that the longer time they're spending on the research for this, the safer this vaccine will be. And so it's very good news that people are spending time. I think it is a very good news that they delayed the release of this vaccine and that they're taking a lot of time to make sure it's safe.
Marty, what are your thoughts?
I agree with Maddie. I definitely think they should get vaccinated. And, you know, the booster question, I think right now we've got basically a monovariant vaccination. I believe in the future we'll start to have a multivariant vaccination and there'll be some customization of this. And that's the game changer, right? Once we can do those things quick enough to be relevant to a surge, I think that changes the game a little bit. As you saw, the vaccine was not as effective at preventing transmission in the Omicron. Once again, it was targeted for a different strain. Everyone should get vaccinated. Pediatrics should get vaccinated. And then on the booster front, I think the dynamics of the question about boosters will come in as we start to get a little bit more tailored to specific strains. I don't know if that agrees with that way you look at it, Maddie.
I think that's a great summary. And the vaccines did reduce transmission prior to Omicron, and it would be great if we could get a booster vaccine that could do that again.
Yeah. I kind of look at this differently in the sense that among our pediatric population, childhood obesity is at record levels at this moment, which is leading to even childhood diabetes. And I'm seeing type 2 diabetes among children at this moment. And as we learned anything about this pandemic is that those who are obese, particularly diabetic, were at the most highest risk for complications. And that's another reason we should consider that, not to mention some of the mitigating factors that we need to do in reference to mental health, physical activity, all these things affecting our population going into the future and presently.
Yeah, I think the only group that's still, I think there's still some question out is the under 6 month. Will there be vaccinations in the early infant phase? And will that be beneficial? And I don't know, Maddie, what your thoughts are on that one.
Yeah, that one I think will take a little time. And usually that will be addressed through the pregnancy is the preferred regimen. So now if you are pregnant and you get vaccinated, there are protective antibodies that are transferred to the baby and in the first 6 months of life. So in general, I think that will probably be the way that they'll go over the next couple of years. And again, they're not the super spreaders, those infants. So they also do not, I don't think, pose like the 0 to 5 year olds, the children at school age. They do increase transmission of the virus considerably and are responsible probably for potential variants in the future.
You remember the flu vaccine. If you want to go right at the transmission, you got to be a little bit more proactive on the IgA mechanisms. Remember back in the flu where there used to be a pretty clear preponderance of the nasal injections to try to create it. I don't think that stuck around very long. I remember for a couple of years in the military, that's how I got my flu vaccine. And then we've gone completely to inoculations since that time. But you could see some of that emerging if they try to be more proactive in intervening on the transmissiveness of the virus.
So we talked about natural immunity, but why don't we hear about herd immunity anymore?
So one of the challenges of getting to herd immunity is the fact that this respiratory virus transmits very effectively before there's symptoms, or even if you don't have symptoms, if you're asymptomatic. This unique quality means that this continues to be spread across populations before you can do contact tracing, before you can quarantine people, et cetera. And because of that, it makes it very difficult to contain. Herd immunity works if the natural immunity is long-lasting. So when you think if you have chickenpox and you get long-lasting immunity from that, right?
Right.
So there used to be, everybody got chickenpox once in their lifetime, and then they had lasting immunity. But when we think about COVID, what we see is the immunity wanes. And so people are getting this infection 2-3 times. We see people in the hospital with it twice, coming in hospitalized twice. So severe infections even the second time. That was not understood in the beginning.
We were working on an original concept that the vaccine would essentially eradicate or get it to almost infinitesimal amounts of risk of catching the virus. That's what we thought. Unfortunately, we didn't do a great job of keeping track of our breakthrough cases in the early phase. Some of the data collection was a little flawed. So we were a little delayed in understanding that this wasn't an inoculation that essentially gave you no risk of catching or transmitting the virus. And so it's taken us a little bit of a time to realize that this, as Maddie said, is a pathogen where the immunity wanes with time. So there's a possibility. So as long as various phases of the population are going through various cycles of their immune response degrading. Basically, there's no wall now of everybody is effectively prevented from getting the virus. That was the original hypothesis that we were hoping. It just didn't pan out that way.
And, you know, I'm thinking about another point, too, that we didn't quite appreciate was the variants that would bypass the immunity. Yep. The only variants that are actually going to make a dent are those that are going to bypass the immunity going forward, since we have so much temporary immunity. And those are likely to continue. So that also challenges herd immunity.
So what about therapeutics available? What seems to be working and what doesn't seem to be working?
We've come a really long way with therapeutics, and I'm going to walk through the meds that are available for non-hospitalized patients now. We've got Paxlovid, which was FDA approved this year. It's an antiviral with this ritonavir boost that helps increase the antiviral levels in your blood. I've mentioned that because of that ritonavir, it can have complications with other medications. So it's not for everybody, but it is the first line treatment for those at high risk of having complications of COVID that are infected. It needs to be given within 5 days of symptoms. So the bigger message here is if you do come down with COVID and develop symptoms, you should see a provider right away, because there are 3 options for treatments for you that can be given early, and they're more effective if they're given early. So Paxlovid is the first one. It's an oral pill twice a day for 5 days. And can be given, 1, if it's available, and 2, if you don't have any contraindications due to other medications. The second drug that is recommended is the monoclonal antibody. And as you know, for Omicron, we only have 1 that's available, so tropimab. But it's a one-time IV dose that can be given outpatient. That's very effective. Both of these reduce hospitalization and death by about 88%. And then the third line treatment is remdesivir, which is given inpatient IV 5 doses and can be given outpatient now for 3 doses, 3 days IV. It's another antiviral, not as effective as Paxlovid, but effective. So you may also hear in the media that remdesivir is not recommended by the World Health Organization. There was a lot of push on the social media about this. So there have been mixed results in the studies. Some studies have shown no impact, but other studies that have been very rigorous, including one in New England Journal of Medicine, showed shorter duration of symptoms, less time on oxygen, less time on ECMO, and lower mortality. And so this is a third line medication on the outpatient side that can be given. And then steroids on the outpatient side, they have recommended it if you're on oxygen. However, it's interesting with these new medications, they're not recommending giving it concomitant with these meds like they do on the inpatient side. Mm-hmm. And that's because there's just not enough data.
What about in reference to the use of Z-Pax? Are antibodies actually indicated for this viral condition?
No.
Yeah, I think it's a simple answer for all 3 of us. The answer is no. So do we see a change? I definitely see a change with Paxlovid specifically. It's kind of, think of it as the Tamiflu equivalent, though it works in a different mechanism. But do we still see this as being a game changer to actually getting to a pandemic state because we have these medications in the ambulatory setting?
Getting to an endemic state, I do. I think these are incredibly effective tools. And I think of getting the symptom and being able to get on a medicine right away, not having to go to the hospital, especially an oral pill, being able to have a shorter course, less severe, similar to a true flu. So right. Yes, that is the hope of these medications. And there will be more. There will be more on the horizon.
So we have these medications that are being available. We have some that are coming in the horizon. Does it still replace vaccination?
No.
Yeah, I think again. Straight answer, folks. The answer is no. We still need to vaccinate. So as the data continues to grow on these medications, is there an opportunity they may be available in the future for exposure?
That's a really good question. Yeah. And I know that's not the intention now, but certainly I think everyone's looking at that. So once we get the supply up and there's some studies out there, I bet that will be one of the first.
They are conducting those studies with some of these medications to see if they can use them in a prophylactic manner.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. I want to thank Manny McDowell and Marty Lucenti for joining us. And they will return for the next episode to continue our discussion. If you'd like to contact them, we'll put their email address on the resource section of our podcast page. And if you have any additional questions pertaining to modern practice or simply want to send us your comments, please contact me at our email, modernpracticepodcast.com. We posted a link in our resource section. And please join us for other Modern Practice Podcasts. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks so much for listening.